Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Collectively Speaking podcast, where I talk to members of or collaborators with the LDN Collective. This is one of a series of podcasts that we're recording in DAR's offices. We're very grateful for them letting us use their fantastic new headquarters here in Chancery Lane. Today, I'm sitting down with two people, Jazz Bala, founder of Jazz Bala Architects, and Vicky Payne. And it's fantastic to speak to them at this particular time. We are heavily involved in one of our most exciting projects, which is for a new community, which is in Huntingdonshire, and very actively involved in planning that new settlement as a sustainable place for the future. I was really interested when I first met Jazz to hear about his background, and hopefully Jazz, you can tell us a bit more about that today, because it's not often in our sector that you meet someone that started off as an urban planner and then went into architecture. And I know from listening to my dad talk about these things for many years that he thinks that that's absolutely the right way around, and I would agree, but it doesn't happen very often, especially now with the cost of tuition and length of courses. But it is a different way of thinking about things, and I can really see that that is very evident on things we're working on together. And Vicky, it's great to have you recently join Jazz, having been working at the Quality of Life Foundation. Really keen to know more about that and your work there, and also even before that, I think you were at David Rudlin Architects and doing a lot of work on garden communities and so on. So Jazz, tell us a bit about what you do and Jazz Bala Architects and what you think really makes you different. There's a lot of architectural practices in London, and I know from experience that you really need to be able to be clear about what you do and what difference you're making. So it'd be good to hear from you about that.
We've been going for about 5 and a bit years now, so we're still quite young. And we've got lots of exciting things on at the moment. The work we do is really built off my dual background in both planning and architecture, and then by virtue of those two, urban design and urbanism. So I originally trained as a planner, as you mentioned. I was working at a couple of practices, urban practitioners who are now part of Allies and Morrison, and later after that, Alan Baxter's. And we did a lot of public sector master planning, and really at the sort of tail end of the new Labour government, a lot of the funding for that type of work really fell through. So it was at that point I made the decision to kind of retrain as an architect, because I always felt it was a kind of itch I never got to scratch, and it felt like a good opportunity or a good moment to go and retrain and get a different skill set and get a different perspective into master planning. I really enjoyed work at the architectural scale, and I think when I came back from the States where I studied, I sort of thought, well, rather than being just doing master planning, I think it'd be more fulfilling to do buildings as well as places and cities and things like that. And now really that's what the practice does. So we're lucky enough to be working on some small projects, sort of retrofit single infill dwellings, all of which is very much informed by context and an appreciation of bigger picture. But then we're doing a lot of interesting stuff on urban strategy, policy, and then new garden communities like we're working together on at Sibson, and then quite complex and challenging urban intensification projects. So we've just started a new project with Barclay Homes, DRMM Architects and NIMTIM Architects in Peckham, which is a very complex urban regeneration scheme. So the practice is really doing a lot of different things, actually at different scales, which is really invigorating, because there's a lot of cross-pollination, I think, in terms of ideas from one scale sponsoring ideas at another scale. So yeah, it's a really exciting time at the moment.
That's great. And it's very much what interested me in working with you in the first place, is I think you do have that appreciation of working at different scales and how everything is interconnected. I wonder, Vicky, is that something that attracted you to work with Jazz? Because it's not something that you can get experience of in many places, because people tend to specialise these days, don't they? But having that breadth and being able to stay connected to different scales is something that I find interesting. Is that one of the things that attracted you?
Yeah, definitely. I think I did a visit to the office when we were first talking about the role, and Jazz introduced me to a bunch of different projects at different scales. And the thing that really attracted me was there's a real continuity of approach between those different scales. So it is, as Jazz said, very context specific, very analytical, quite nuanced, like very aware also of the practical implications of things, which I think can sometimes get lost when you're looking at urban design projects, particularly at that earlier scale. It was definitely something that was of interest. And also I think coming at urban design from a slightly different background, because I came at it from illustration, an art foundation course after school, went and studied illustration in Manchester. And then partway through my first year in the summer, I watched Kevin MacLeod and the Big Town Plan on Channel 4.
Yes.
And I was like, I want to be a planner. So yeah, that's my tangential roots into planning and urban design.
Really? Oh, that's fantastic. I didn't realise that. I have to look at some of your illustrations. I think we're always in the lookout for good illustrators. When you were at Urbet, I think you were there when they were involved in the Wolfson Prize, which was the Garden Communities of the Future, which won the award, didn't it?
Yeah.
And so I'd be just a bit interested to hear about that and how that came about and how you think that might have influenced things too.
Yeah, so the Wolfson was ever so slightly before my time. So that was 2014 and I joined in 2015. I was there for the really exciting part, which was we won the Wolfson Prize. We had all this interest in garden communities and the work that we'd done. And then we started getting actual projects that were trying to implement that thinking. And the first one that I was involved in was for Barratt Developments, weirdly, possibly not an organization that you would associate with taking a very kind of innovative, forward-looking approach, but they came to us because they wanted to do something different with a strategic site that they had for, I think it was like 8,000 homes split across two sites. They were going to do two new railway stations. There was a huge country park, which is part of the social contract aspect of that garden community, you know, like a certain percentage of the land is given over to public use and to public open space. And we took that a reasonable way. So we developed a full master plan for it, making the case to the local authority. We didn't get as far as application stage because it was addressing Birmingham's housing need, and they got into all sorts of difficulties with their local plan in terms of how those numbers were going to be split between them and adjacent authorities. So to my knowledge, it's never turned into anything, but it was a really, really exciting project to work on because it was taking all of that thinking and applying it to a real site.
Interesting. Well, who knows? It might well happen in the future. That's the way these things often work, is you can't really suppress a good idea for too long, can you? And the politics, there's the short-term nature of politics is often rubs against the sort of long-term nature of urban planning, doesn't it? But that sounds like a fascinating project. And Jazz, I know that you've also got involved in the sort of thought leadership side of things. One of the things that you showed me when we first met was the work you did for Clarion, who have their own... Is the William Sutton Prize, which is who was their founder, was he?
So Clarion, I think, was a merger of two different housing associations, one of which was Affinity Sutton. So William Sutton was the sort of philanthropist that headed it up and left a very large endowment to the organisation for sort of endeavours that have some sort of social pursuit, so for the betterment of people, planet, things like that.
Right. Tell us about your submission and why it won the prize.
So it was a really great competition. I'd sort of recommend anybody who's got an idea out there in placemaking, housing, sustainability, architecture, urbanism, to have a look at it for next year, because it's quite a generous winning fee and you don't need to do too much to kind of make a submission. It's quite open-ended. But when we won the prize, it was more about affordable housing and placemaking. And we put forward a sort of concept that we termed radial routes, which was looking at densification along A roads in outer London. So it was through, and again, this is very much the combination of skills or backgrounds in different scales. It was looking at using a kind of typological approach to identify routes on the outside of London that, as far as London's concerned, aren't amazingly well served by public transport, in that they are not 5 minutes from a tube station. But if you kind of take a national view, they're actually very well served from public transport. They're all on bus routes, you know, they're probably 15 minutes away from a rail station, which is, by the kind of UK measure, very strong public transport. They're often very low density and they're often very low quality housing as well. And what the approach tried to do was to recognize that these could be corridors for growth, for sort of urban boulevards, to encourage growth there. And sort of we specifically sought out routes that had very mixed or no prevailing character. So there was, they probably could absorb more transformation. They're not in conservation areas. They often are the sort of boundary to a neighbourhood rather than being a high street that people feel particularly attracted to or attached to. It's a sort of place where you might get a row of single story shopping parades next to a couple of lonely Victorian terraces, next to a Esso garage and a big yellow box storage. So we just chose to look at London, but that condition, it's around the periphery of every major UK city. And so the idea was using design coding to encourage intensification along those routes, allowing slightly more height, with the idea that, you know, you could get better design quality and then also larger provisions of affordable housing.
And just sort of switching from sort of thinking about urban regeneration to these sort of new settlements, which is one of the projects that we're very heavily involved in at the moment, is you mentioned, is Sibson. And it is an incredible opportunity and privilege to be able to be thinking about designing a community of the future that is currently greenfield, but could well house up to sort of 15,000 people and a lot of new employment space for these sort of green technology and innovation companies. We had a workshop recently, which was really interesting, with Lord Matthew Taylor, who wrote the government policies on garden communities and is effectively part of the master planning team. And it was thinking about what the town centre of the future might look like, which is interesting because most of the time when you're looking at town centres and high streets, you're regenerating existing high streets and town centres and you're retrofitting them. But this is a completely different type of challenge and opportunity, wasn't it? And Vicky, I know that it all got very intense and there was lots of scribbling and crossing out and different colour coding. And, you know, it was an amazing day. But I was just quite interested to know your sort of thoughts and takeaways from that and your hopes or fears for those types of projects.
I think, it is a privilege to be designing at that level, and it sort of taps into when I first started studying planning at university. When you get into the real world, it's all about, you know, like land use budgets and the economics, but the first year of planning for me was all about like these utopian ideals, and I think all planners have a bit of a sense of like, you know, positivity and utopian thinking about them, so it's very satisfying in that sense. When it comes to designing a new town centre from scratch, I think it's a very, very hard thing to do. New settlements in and of themselves are at a disadvantage because they're not evolving naturally. And then something as sensitive and nuanced as town centres, which are often coming from such a rich history of like being at the crossroads of somewhere, or they've just evolved in a very specific place in a very specific way over a period of time. And so trying to do that like retroactively is incredibly complex. And I think it helped us in that session to be looking at what sort of scale of place we might be looking at, because I think what can happen sometimes with new settlements is people overestimate what a town centre of that size and in that location can support. We looked at some market town context to try and get an urban form and get a sort of scale of use and quantum of use that felt appropriate and that felt intimate. And I think it was useful for me because I was a co-author of a book on high streets, which came out this year, little plug. And I think one of the lessons we learned from that is around flexibility, because the town centres that have fared really badly in sort of what we characterised as a retail crisis, not a high street crisis, over the last few years are places that tailored their urban form to very specific uses, and in some cases, very specific users. So like Debenhams, for example, you have these big floor plate stores or these malls, and they've been designed for one specific use. And when that use goes away, or, you know, circumstances change, that, you know, you're kind of into getting into difficulty. So what we kind of brought to the Sibson thinking is the idea of having much smaller units, and having units that are flexible and that can evolve over time, and an awareness that we're designing for somewhere that is going to exist decades into the future, and we maybe don't know what that place is going to need right now.
I think in that respect, I'd say that actually you can learn a lot from existing town centres to sort of plug in what we should be doing in the next 40, 50 years. I think there probably isn't, although it is much harder starting from a standing start to kind of get that energy. I think you do need to look at historic places, the way they're configured, the way the ground floor is calibrated, to then come up with a sort of nuanced approach to what we think could work in the middle of a green field, essentially, in 10, 15 years' time. I mean, it's, again, just thinking about cross-pollination, it's interesting how all these, you have a conversation, one project, and then it informs like three others. Like, so, you know, some of the high street regeneration we're doing, where we, through engagement exercises, we hear a lot of emphasis placed on independent retailers and people wanting, the community wanting sort of local shops. I think there's lessons to be learned from Vicky's research and the stuff we're doing at Sibson, which is about smaller, flexible units, you know, falling underneath the business rates threshold, like all these small things that you can do, simple units that are sort of repeatable, that you can let quickly, which then facilitates more of a kind of an independent ecosystem of shops, which is really interesting. And alongside the practice work, I do a lot of design review. And on Friday, I was at a review for Sevenoaks, and we were looking at one of their high streets. So this is a bit of a segue, but it's just to sort of highlight how much these things, ideas come round. And the town council were looking at how to accommodate some new housing on their high street. And it was a really beautiful high street, but it was actually struggling quite a lot. There was a lot of vacancy. I didn't have much confidence that any of the shops that are open today are going to be surviving in, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, especially the independents. And you wonder why, because it's actually quite an affluent part of the UK. It's relatively well connected. It's a really, you know, by all objective standards, a beautiful, inverted commas, high street. And the reason is because there's a Waitrose at the back of the high street, which completely turns its back onto it. And the steer we had from the town parish was very much about beautifying some of the buildings on the high street, which didn't fit in architecturally. And that might be something one wants to do, but we had to really push back and say, it may work, it may not work, but it's not going to secure the future of the high street in the long term or the medium term. What you really need to do is look at the fact that Waitrose is really, really busy around the corner, and it's because everyone's driving there. There's no reason to get out your car and go to the high street. You get in your car, you do your shopping, and you leave again. You need to kind of engage with them, look at how they can modify their assets to have a better spatial relationship with the rest of the high street. And those are, you know, very similar conversations that we've been having on Sibson about how you accommodate retail units of different sizes.
I do think that is a really important point. So we had, I think it was 8 recommendations at the end of the book of how to support high streets in the future. And the last one deliberately was things like public realm improvements and aesthetic improvements, which for us as urban designers, you know, you kind of want to think that all of your work and your design thinking is going to, you know, save the high street. But there's far more structural and economic issues that dictate whether a place is going to be successful. And I think as urban designers, you have to be really mindful of the fact that design isn't your only tool.
Yes. Well, that's interesting and good to hear you say that. I think one of the things that becomes obvious the more of these types of projects you work on is that it's not really about aesthetics or physical appearance. It's actually about sustainability, isn't it, in terms of making places more resilient by being more mixed use, but also reducing the need to get in your car, as you're saying, Jazz, and drive to an out-of-town shopping centre or a school that's miles away, or commute into work. If you can have all of the things you need, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk these days about 15, 20-minute cities.
Yeah, I was wondering when that was going to come up. Yeah, I'm not sure we're allowed to do that anymore, are we? It's 15-minute cities are banned. Well,
I think that seems to me to be complete madness, to be honest. It's like banning talking about climate change or something, isn't it?
Which is the week before.
I think it's important that we're a bit bolder, isn't it, about and more assertive about these things. It's often not the case because as consultants, we tend to be led by the political environment or the client's agenda. But I think there is more and more of a sort of a need for leadership coming from people that really understand these things in a way that perhaps the public haven't been able to, because you know they don't really get the same level of information, and that's something I think the LDN Collective is trying to change too, is that sort of public engagement with these issues. And how, you know, if somebody pipes up at a party conference and says 15-minute cities are evil, that the public won't buy that because they understand the benefits. But that's probably a whole nother podcast. So it's a question I'm particularly interested to hear your response to, which is quite open-ended, and it might be that your answer is none of these things, but I'd be interested to know if you think of yourself as either an agitator, an activator, an ambassador, or a protector.
It's a tough one. I think it probably be some combination of an agitator and was the third one ambassador, an agitated ambassador maybe. To add some context, that probably because a lot of the work we do is research based, which tries to shift the dial on things like car based suburban development or sustainability, retrofit, quality of housing accommodation, some of the sort of thought leadership stuff you reference. So I guess that would fall into the agitated bucket. But then I guess as a practice that is also interested in building and moving things forward, there is a kind of ambassadorial quality, without that sounding too grandiose. So probably a combination, I'd say.
That's good. Oh, that's actually how I see you, Jazz. So that's... good to know that you would put yourself in that bracket, because I think there is something very diplomatic about the way you go about projects, which is also very important. So Vicky, putting the same question to you.
The one that immediately jumped out at me was agitator, because I quite often feel passionately about things, but then I'm very aware that agitating forcefully, and particularly one of the things that I feel really strongly about, is not chastising people and like browbeating people and making them feel bad for whatever perspective they're holding. I think the role of a designer and somebody who is trying to be really proactive and positive in this space is taking people on the journey and showing them different ways of doing things that can work for them. And I think maybe the activator role falls more into that. So I think when I'm having conversations with people, I'm trying as far as possible not to get too far into, oh, isn't everything terrible? Or isn't it awful that this person thinks this thing? But actually being a bit more proactive and clever about it and saying like, okay, well, what might be possible?
So just to sort of think about a particular example of that, because I think that's brilliant. It's often overlooked is the need to take people on that journey with you, and actually... changing behaviours is one of the hardest parts of what we do in terms of urban planning. And obviously with the party conferences and manifestos and recent announcements about car ownership becoming very public and debated, people are very wedded to their cars, aren't they? But we all understand that we need to be less so, not just because of the environmental impact that cars have, including electric cars with the embodied carbon that is needed to produce them, and also the particulates that come off tyres and so on, that is often not that well understood. But the benefits of having more active lifestyles and choosing to ride a bike or walk when you might not have done previously. So in your work, I know that you do a lot of thinking about this. So could you give us some sort of more concrete, or that's probably a bad choice of word, more tangible examples of how you are helping reduce people's dependency on cars when you're doing through urban design.
So I guess that more relates to the urbanism we do in new communities or outside of London, which we do quite a bit of. The probably best example is the work we undertook for Essex County Council last year, which I understand is due to be published any minute now. So hopefully once that comes out, we can point people in the direction. But it was essentially some quite in-depth research which looked at suburban development across the county and actually nationally for best practice. I think to take a step back, I think, and to build on what Vicky was saying, I think what we try to do as a practice is very much engage with some of the challenges that reality throws at you, because sometimes one of the shortcomings of sort of purely architectural approach to things is the suspension of certain constraints, because, you know, it's easier to not engage with them and they're seen as a you know, hampering creativity. Whereas I think we as a practice try to really come up and take seriously some of the challenges, be they economic, social, whatever. And in suburban development, it's often car ownership, connectivity, and a lack of active travel options. So we took lots of different case studies across the UK and looked for elements of best practice in some of them. So be it reducing form factor by encouraging more terrace housing rather than semi-detached or detached homes, looking at encouraging pooled off-plot car parking rather than having two car parking places stacked on your plot, looking at having slightly shorter back-to-back distances in the way housing is configured. So all of which trying to get your development to be slightly more compact, slightly more dense, and then enabling a slight more richer mix of uses to kind of embed some of that thinking. Because I think part of it is we need to get, I think our greenfield development has to work much harder. Like, I don't think, you know, as we move forward, the number of homes we have to deliver and the limited space we have to do it, it means that sort of, you know, conventional suburban development at 30 dwellings per hectare is just not viable. It's not a it doesn't constitute optimum use of land, and to revert to our previous conversation about town centres, it doesn't allow us to sponsor sort of active uses. And so we need to get things slightly denser, we need to get that land working harder, and then I think the second thing is that people now expect a lot more from their residential development. With people working from home 2 or 3 days a week almost exclusively, the idea of having a sort of dormitory type configuration where you commute by car or by train from one place into your active city, that's kind of gone now, and people expect to have access to a sort of place away from home that they can work, a cafe or, you know, some sort of mixed use element.
That's really interesting and insightful, and you know, I think you can tell that your practice is very much driven by values, but also being pragmatic and thinking about people's lives and the reality. If you're a single mum and you need to do the weekly shop with you and you've got two young children, it's very hard to suggest doing that on a bicycle or walking. You know, you've got to have options, but it's all about sort of gradually changing and steering people in the right direction, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the distinction we always try to push is that having access to a car and car ownership in its current form are not the same thing. They can lead to quite dramatically different types of urban form. Yeah, or even just moving to a place where there's a single on-plot space rather than three or four per family home would be a marked improvement.
Well, there is a sort of education awareness raising piece within the industry there as well, because I was at an event recently and it turns out that there was an agent that was telling people that were buying new homes in a new development that their homes would be more valuable. They were given the choice of either having a second car park or space or a home office. And they were told that the house would be more valuable if they chose the second car park space, which actually wasn't true, but it meant that everyone went for that option. And so there's often things, forces at play that can really influence things.
I think there's something on site selection as well. So once you've got to the point where development is being built, often there are huge opportunities in terms of sustainability that have already been missed. And at my previous practice, Urbed, I was involved in a few strategic spatial planning projects, which looked at the site allocation process in a different way. So it's using open source data and QGIS, taking out initially the environmental constraints, then plotting buffers around planned and existing transport, existing local centres, basically places where people wouldn't need to use a car that much, and using that as a means of identifying sites for development. So your call for sites process, instead of being a complete free-for-all where you say, okay, does anyone have land? Like, let's see it. And then you assess each site on its merits. This was taking a slightly different approach where you identify an area where you might like to have a site come forward and then potentially start inviting people to bring those to you.
Interesting. So, but more sort of proactive and data-led. Yeah, I often have a problem with that term, call for sites. It implies there's no planning going on at all, doesn't it? It's kind of, you tell us. So just in terms of the future, moving forward, what are you excited about, and what's next for Jazz Banner Architects and for you both?
That's a big question. As I mentioned in the beginning, we've got, it's a really sort of exciting, I think, 6 months or so ahead that we've got planned. The first thing to kind of comment on, I think, as an architectural design practice, being able to see 6 months in the future in and of itself is a positive place to be. So we've got some really interesting projects that we're really excited about progressing either to planning, or some smaller projects that we're excited about completing on site up until the spring. We're redoing the website to kind of, I think, better reflect the breadth of work that we're undertaking. And the company's grown quite a bit in the last sort of 6 to 12 months. We've had, you know, great people like Vicky come and join. And so I think part of that growth is also just understanding new structures of managing things internally, which sounds quite banal, but it's actually, again, quite really, really exciting. So there's a lot to look forward to. And I think the bigger thing, I think, probably just on the industry, I think we, as an industry, we're probably all looking for a bit more certainty from government, a bit more direction, a bit more you know, plans for long-term growth, which despite certain slogans, I think we're kind of moving away from. I think we're very excited and busy about the short term. But in the medium term, I think there's a lot of, you know, really big challenges in terms of housing and net zero that designers, planners, architects are all really well placed to help assist the UK with. And it'll be nice when we're in a place where there's a kind of political will behind some of that stuff.
Great stuff, Jazz. And Vicky, how about you? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm very excited to keep working with Jazz, obviously. I've been here, I think, a month, and to keep working on Sibson. I am also chair of the RTPI's Urban Design Network, and we have our conference on the 2nd of November. So I'm in the process of kind of sculpting that. That sounds like a very grandiose term. It's about design solutions to the housing crisis. Like fool that I am, I'm still hopeful that a Labour government might decide to really take planning seriously. And hopeful that we might see some better approaches to that and better outcomes.
Hear, hear. Well, thank you so much, Jazz and Vicky. That was just a brilliant and very insightful conversation. Great to hear more about what you're up to, and really good to hear there's reasons to be optimistic as well about the future, working with people like you who really care about the important issues, but are also thinking very pragmatically about how we can incorporate thinking around sort of social impact, environmental impact into the places that we're designing right now. Keep an eye out for the new brand for Jazz Bala, and also the publication of those Essex design guidelines. I'm looking forward to seeing that, Jazz. And also keep an eye out for Vicky's book about high streets, which I'm told is available through the RIBA. Amazon and other bookshops are available. And thank you both very much indeed. And it's been a brilliant session, and looking forward to carrying on working with you both.